crucial, Hunt refused to relinquish any control over the assets, and Bill Hawser soon found his job to be not just ordering artillery, but playing traffic cop for Cobra gunships that popped out of the smoke right through the trajectory of friendly incoming artillery fire. For much of the battle, Hunt flew around the battlefield well above the action, at oxygen starvation altitude, as one officer who accompanied him put it, yelling and screaming and asking for the latest body count, or making his own by directing fire onto enemy no one else in his chopper could see. The figures for all kills he personally made sure were reported back to the brigade talk during the battle. At one stage, he called me and my loach to say he was going to bring some gunships in by the canal at the inside edge of my battalion's position. I told him negative, it was too dangerous, and went back to fighting my battalion. Gunships at the best of times were lousy for close-in support. To even contemplate using them that way in the dark with all that smoke and confusion on the ground was insane. Hell, if I didn't know exactly where my boundaries were, how could the gunship pilots? I'd barely finished the thought when I saw it. A Cobra making a run right at my A company, miniguns and rockets blazing. I got on the air-to-air freak to tell the pilot to break off, only to see him turn around and come back for a second run. I couldn't stop him. He hosed down the company again. Those rockets and miniguns were scorching the earth, A Company squad leader Bob Lacey later described those moments on the wrong end of this savage U.S. firepower, and all I could think of was I was glad I wasn't a VC. When I saw the Cobra coming around for a third pass, I was wild. I told my loach pilot to switch on all his navigational lights and hover over my people so the gunship couldn't get in. It worked. Then I called the acting company commander, Lieutenant John Roberson III. Roberson was a South Carolinian Citadel stud of the highest caliber. He actually belonged to D Company, but whenever I was short a commander, I turned to him to fill in. Now I was asking him if his unit was okay. "Yes, sir," he replied. "We've got four, maybe five wounded." I noticed a crack in Roberson's voice. "How about you?" I asked. "Just a scratch, sir," he said. Roberson's scratch had actually been losing a finger on one hand to a flying piece of shrapnel while he was talking on the radio trying to call off the gunship fire. Charlie Winsor, the fourth of the 39th's HQ company medic, who always seemed to be thrown into the breach when a problem arose in the field, patched Roberson up that night, and said the lieutenant refused morphine until just before he was evacuated rather than leave his company in the lurch. Now that was hardcore. What a good man. I called Hunt on the brigade net. "Okay, you've done your bit, Colonel. Your gunship's wounded five of my men. Are you satisfied now?" Hunt had nothing to say to me, but I heard later he immediately turned to another officer in the chopper and asked, panicking, "Don't you think I did right there?" Through the battle, Hunt's insistence on controlling just about everything and everyone led to confusion and frustration on the ground and in the air. It came as no surprise to most of us then, when upon the ultimate completion of the seal in the still dark early hours of the morning, the enemy had long split the scene, if he had even been there in any big numbers in the first place. When daylight came, the battlefield was swept. My units on the north side of the canal had killed 27 VC during the entire fight, mostly small groups of stragglers fleeing the impact area. Sullivan's men on the south had gotten a dozen or so more, and though TAC air and gunships may have killed more still, there were no bodies or weapons to be counted. So there were about 40 enemy dead. Yet Hunt was convinced that we'd annihilated a large force. In fact, when he returned to the brigade talk after the height of the fighting, apparently he was very upset to see the Dick board had recorded a lower body count than he remembered reporting. So he called division, said there'd been a mistake, and gave them a higher figure. The next morning, two choppers arrived from division at Dong Tam with a bevy of journalists whom Hunt wanted to brief personally at the site of his great battle. The fact that said battle had actually started out as a screw-up in one of the 2nd of the 39th companies, for which its CO was later relieved, and barely improved from there, went unmentioned. 15 reporters came and went home believing, first, that we'd engaged and demolished a VC battalion of some 430 men, questionable at best, and second, that 57 enemy bodies had been found on the battlefield. An outright lie. In any event, Hunt's caucus race was drawing to a close, and it was time to give out the medals. The 9th Div had quite a system organized for this task. The first time I'd walked into the battalion's awards and decorations section at Dong Tam, I'd been amazed to see nearly a dozen guys madly churning out citations. "Sir, it's General Ewell's policy that every man in this division get 2 awards before he goes home," one of them had explained. This was the end result of Ewell's determination, according to Major Edwin E. Deagle, Jr., who had been the division's special assistant to the Chief of Staff for Combat Research and Analysis, that the enlisted men of the 9th get their fair share of awards vis-a-vis the officers, and that was fair enough. But another part of Ewell's policy required Silver Stars, Bronze Stars, Distinguished Flying Crosses, and other such mid-level valor decorations be awarded to the 9th Division's combat leaders at the same rate, according to Deagle, as was done in other divisions, even if inflated so as not to penalize them professionally. This was a typical example of the prostitution of the awards system in Vietnam, which in turn rendered individual decorations virtually meaningless. The blind enthusiasm of the awards and decorations machine actually netted me a Silver Star in the 9th Division for an act I did not perform during an action that occurred after I left the 4th of the 39th. I had to go to Saigon to MACVAG, Adjutant General, to have the order rescinded and the award removed from my records. According to Hank Emerson, one good part of Ewell's awards policy was the general's adamant refusal to give himself SCG or the other general officers in the division these same valor decorations. This was a far cry from, say, the 1st Division under Dupuy, where it seemed most field grade officers and above, to include Commanding General Dupuy himself, received at least 1 Distinguished Service Cross, Distinguished Flying Cross, Silver Star, and Bronze Star V during his tour, not to mention a Legion of Merit and countless air medals, the latter of which, according to MACV policy, were automatic issue for every 25 hours a man spent flying over a combat area. It was almost like an awards package in the Big Red One, which you received if you performed in any way admirably while with the unit. Bernard Rogers, for example, received a DFC for relaying vital information obtained by making repeated low passes over the battle area to determine the strength and battle formation of hostile forces to ground commanders of an engaged Arving unit, and for flying at a dangerously low altitude to ensure the maximum effectiveness of the friendly supporting fires he was at the time both calling and adjusting. For a brigadier general slash assistant division commander, it was hardly a remarkable DFC-winning achievement any more than the action that resulted in Rogers being awarded an air medal with the Valor device. Apparently, the general, with complete disregard for his personal safety, leaned precariously out of his aircraft to maintain visual contact with the friendly forces and to search for enemy troop concentrations. Also mentioned favorably in the Air Medal V citation was Rogers's ability to operate the console radio of the aircraft under severely adverse conditions. At least the 9th Division didn't stretch that far to look after its own. After Mi Phuoc Thai, when I got a call from division saying I was to prepare a statement about the battle for a Distinguished Service Cross for Ira Hunt, and I refused, about the same time a Spec 4 from division walked into Jim Musselman's Brigade S3 office and informed him, "I'm here to assist you to write a DSC for Colonel Hunt," and Musselman threw him out of his office, I was left alone, and to my knowledge Hunt went without a Valor Award for the operation. 6 weeks later, I was told to report to Hunt at division. The Chief of Staff even sent his personal chopper to pick me up from danger. When we met, it was alone with no witnesses, and it was all "let bygones be bygones" stuff. The many head-on confrontations we'd had throughout his stint were, to Hunt at least, forgotten. He handed me a draft paper he called The History of the Battle of Tan Phu, a historical report that he, members of his staff, and a POW taken by Arvin subsequent to the events of 11 through 12 March, but who had been at Mu Phuoc Thai, had put together. I really couldn't believe what I was being asked to read. With SLAM, I'd seen my share of false reports. In the Pentagon, I'd experienced my share of snow jobs, but to me, this was the quintessential false report, the absolute ultimate snow job, a flawless description of a perfect SEAL operation that bore little resemblance to what actually happened on the ground at Tan Phu Mi Phuoc Thai under Hunt's command. The already inflated body count figure of 57 was inexplicably raised to 72 in Hunt's account of the battle in this report. The prisoner Hunt had assisted him corroborated most of what Hunt had to say, except the body count figures. According to the POW, his battalion had actually been gutted with 203 KIA. Hunt wanted me, of all people, to endorse this load of self-serving bullshit. Naturally, I refused, as he must have thought I would, for he immediately sweetened the pot by insinuating that if I endorsed it, he would make sure the hardcore was considered for a valorous unit citation. I refused again, though what commander wouldn't want a valorous unit citation for his unit, and unsurprisingly, the 4th of the 39th didn't get a VUC for this or any other action while I was in command, well deserved as it would have been. Ira Hunt, on the other hand, hadn't needed my endorsement anyway, as things turned out. His History of the Battle of Tan Phu, 11 through 12 March 1969, in its final, for official use only, elaborate but no more accurate form, was given wide distribution throughout Vietnam. I, for one, saw it 2 years later just as I was about to speak at the Vietnamese War College. It hit General Abrams's desk, and I heard it made it back to the States, too, to be used at Benning as an example of a perfect SEAL. George Mergner even found a copy of it on a subsequent tour to Panama, 71 through 74, translated into Spanish. To me, it was the perfect hoax, the faker outfaking the fakers, even making a point in the process of absolving himself of any responsibility for personally ordering gunships into my battalion position and blowing John Roberson's finger off, as well as wounding four more of my men, a mishap, Hunt wrote in the History, which occurred when a flare caught some VC out in the open and the Cobra pilot with instant reflexes cut loose with his miniguns. Hunt's narrative continues, "It looked to me as if he cut down at least 10 VC. Shortly thereafter, Alpha, 4th of the 39th, north of the canal, complained that they were being shot up. The prisoner who validated so many of Hunt's claims and whose own account made Hunt's report, in Hunt's own words, an historical document of some significance because the opportunity did not arise too often for such an exercise, was nothing if not an eager accessory to Hunt's deception. I'd been too busy fighting my battalion to pay much attention when word filtered down from Dong Tam that a Viet Cong had been taken who'd been at Mi Phuoc Thai, so I didn't know that the method of interrogation this prisoner, derisively nicknamed Super P by members of the division staff, underwent had him sitting around the chief of staff's office at division headquarters being treated like $1 million and being wined and dined on ice cream from the general's mess. It sure beat being shot at, and little wonder the POW knew just the right things to say. But to me, probably the saddest part of the Battle of Mi Phuoc Thai and the historical report that came out of it was the conclusion of the powers that be, when the opportunity arose 2 years later to re-examine the fight and the bogus zero-defect report that was being used as a bona fide teaching aid in Vietnam, in the U.S., and God only knew where else, that the account of the Battle of Tan Phu, Mi Phuoc Thai, while perhaps not entirely accurate, cannot be considered a false report. Such understanding of the less than perfect, candid, honest, particularly in a West Pointer and a general officer, which Hunt was at the time, was a first in my Army experience. The re-examination of the Battle of Mi Phuoc Thai occurred in connection with my speaking out publicly about the Army's performance in Vietnam and the ticket punchers typified by Ira A. Hunt, who were too often in control, Unfortunately, the Army was far more concerned with denying my credibility than anything else at that time, and the truth of the Mi Phuoc Thai battle was just another casualty in the campaign. In any event, in the middle of March 1969, Hunt went back to division and the brigade he left behind collapsed from exhaustion, immersion foot, overexposure, and abuse. Then we got up, gingerly licked our wounds, and tried to regroup. It was the second time this had proved necessary. Old-timers of the brigade said Hunt had crippled the unit when he'd been put in charge after Hank Emerson was hit, too, in the month until Geraci arrived. Now, as then, maintenance of soldiers and equipment had become non-existent. The brigade was shot, and it took weeks before anyone was really operating at full speed again. As a result, these were not the happiest weeks for the new brigade commander, John Hayes. When he'd first arrived to OJT with Hunt for a few days before taking over, apparently both Hunt and Ewell had told him that if he didn't get as high a body count as Hunt was achieving, he wouldn't be with the division long. Now, as the brigade limped along, not making a lot of great contacts as it tried to heal itself, Hunt was riding Hayes, saying shit like when he was skipper, the brigade was really performing, and asking what was wrong with Hayes, that under him the unit wasn't doing a damn thing. Fortunately, throughout this period, the hardcore was still providing Hayes with a good solid body count every day through our well-established, highly successful sniper program. The sniper capability in Vietnam had been Hank Emerson's idea, born when we were in the Pentagon together. Hank had gone to Fort Benning and gotten half the Army Marksmanship Detachment assigned TDY to the 9th Division in Vietnam, to have them train selected old reliable troops as the division snipers who would then be farmed out to units in the field. When Hank got shot down, the program basically collapsed, so when I got to the 4th of the 39th, it was just a good idea waiting to be exploited. I wanted to develop a stronger sniper capability on the battalion level, so I brought my guys back after their training at the excellent Division Sniper School, outfitted them with sniper rifles and starlight scopes, and put them up in the four observation towers of the firebase. A good sniper could drill your teeth with one of those scopes if you were unfortunate enough to be picked up walking along on a night patrol, and in conjunction with the small infantry radar system Geraci had brought into the brigade, which could locate by blip any and all personnel approaching the concern still outside the starlight scope's range, we began to get good numbers on the old dick board. The only problem was that once Charlie realized we'd learned to pierce the night somehow, he didn't come around anymore. It was the way he was with everything. Whatever magic formula for winning the Americans came up with, be it APCs or choppers, people sniffers, hydrofoils, or electronic fences, the minute Charlie figured out that whatever we were up to was bad for his health, he just stopped playing the game, at least until he came up with a countermeasure. McNamara's fence across the DMZ, as just one example, was $1 billion later about to be more or less abandoned because the enemy now scooted around it, as any professional soldier knew he would, through Laos and Cambodia. And when soon down the track, the 4th of the 39th started doing tremendous damage to the Viet Cong outfits in our AO, and no matter how they tried to outfox us, we were too organized and too alert to fall for it, they simply rethought their situation and returned to a very old practice. They packed about 300 pounds of explosives into a box, put it on a catapult, not unlike the ones used in medieval times to crash into an opponent's fortress, and in the middle of the night, flung the damn thing over our berm. I was sleeping in the corner of the connex we used as our battalion talk when the device exploded. I was hurled to the top of that tin box, bounced off it a couple of times, and was then kind of propelled through the door. It would have leveled the CP, killing me as well as a number of the snipers, who were wounded as they slept in a bunker nearby, but for a 2.5-ton water tanker that was fortuitously parked between my CP complex and the outer berm, and which took the brunt of the blast. But I had to hand it to the Viet Cong. They were like little ants struggling with the crust of bread. They never gave up, and nothing wore them out. So, meanwhile, they'd stopped playing ball with our snipers in the observation towers. We needed a new gimmick. I called in Larry Taller, an OSC drafty lieutenant and nice Jewish boy from New York who'd found his niche as the sniper's boss. I told him my problem and asked him to have a think about this idea I had to put snipers on choppers. In short order, Night Hunter was born. Two snipers and three helicopters, a slick and two gunships, made up each Night Hunter team. The choppers flew in blackout, the slick just a couple of hundred meters off the deck, its sniper passengers lying prone in the back, checking out the crisscrossing Delta canals and trails with starlight scopes. The gunships, meanwhile, hovered maybe 500 meters overhead. If through their scopes the snipers saw enemy below, they and the slick's door gunners would take them under fire, with weapons loaded with tracer rounds. This showed the gunships exactly where in the pitch-black night the target was, and in turn, the gunships would hose the area down. The slick could also drop Air Force flares to light up the contact area, and a reaction force was always ready and waiting at the firebase if a target justified piling on. From the outset, Night Hunter was incredibly successful, with scores of dead VC and no friendly casualties at all. Geraci, who was still in command when the program began, loved the idea and loved the result, and made sure Taller, who as Night Hunter 6 was in charge, got the assets every night. After one particularly fruitful nighttime outing, Geraci even ordered everyone who'd participated to his office at 0700 to give each one an award. And while it was true that most of our greatest successes were in the first few weeks, before Charlie realized we had something magic in the sky and began to be more careful how he moved, for me, Night Hunter was the first step in my quest to turn off the Americans' stage lights. We would no longer be counterinsurgents who, like actors on a well-lit stage, gave all their secrets away to an unseen, silent, and ever-watchful insurgent audience in a darkened theater. Instead, we would approach the battlefield and the war as our enemy approached it, and in so doing, began to out-guerrilla the guerrilla, out-G the G, as I hammered it again and again into the men of the hardcore, and win. To this end, from Night Hunter evolved another role for the snipers, this one in daylight. In the early hours of the morning, two-man sniper teams, armed with sniper rifles and silencers and smokeless ammo, an M79 and a radio, would be inserted around the battle area by unescorted slicks. Under a Hessian camouflage cloth, positioned feet to feet on their bellies, these guys would just lie on the ground in the middle of bandit country, waiting for something to happen. If they saw a half-dozen VC coming toward their ambush, they'd start with the last guy and pop them all off one by one. If the enemy were spotted nearby but going in the wrong direction, that is, away from the ambush, the snipers would just call for artillery or airstrikes to drive them into range. As with Night Hunter, the daytime sniper program was tremendously successful. The result of it all was that the snipers, like the Tigers before them in the first of the 327th, became my pets. I called them my little babies and showered them with attention and recognition for their contribution to the battalion's effort. I even gave them their own uniforms, camouflage a la Tigers, with the added touch of black berets with the red Rakondo patch sewed on. In many respects, the sniper's job was easier than the average trooper's sorry lot in a line company. The snipers didn't have to slog through the chest-deep mud of the paddies for days on end or constantly be on the lookout for killer booby traps. But what they did, especially on the daylight operations, took an incredible amount of balls, and I admired them for it. The psychological element of the job couldn't be dismissed either. The high-powered sniper scopes brought the enemy visually within arm's reach, a connection between the hunter and the hunted that most infantrymen were spared. A certain constitution was thus required in a sniper, especially when among your targets could well be women or young girls. This was the case for Larry Taller one morning as he surveyed a group of six dead VC he and another sniper had taken at a creek bend. "And I turned my scope on this one," he told me upon his return, "and it was a girl, and all I could think was how beautiful she was." It was just another strange element in a strange and difficult war. The snipers were just one among many ideas I was experimenting with to make the 4th of the 39th a real guerrilla battalion. Even before Hunt left, I'd implemented some changes, and by the time Hayes was firmly in the saddle, the reorganization was almost complete. The basic concepts behind my changes were that men, not helicopters or mechanical gimmicks, won battles, and that the only way to defeat the present enemy in the present war at a low cost in friendly casualties was through adopting the enemy's own tactics, that is, out-G-ing the G through surprise, deception, cunning, mobility, which was where helicopters came in handy, not as magic panacea, but as a vehicle to move men quickly into battle, imagination, and familiarity with the terrain. In the end, and in an otherwise even match, our unbeatable firepower would always turn the tide of battle in our favor. But to use that hammer least wastefully, and to its fullest effect, first required the basic skills of men. Each hardcore company specialized in a particular facet of guerrilla warfare as tailored to our needs. Alert and Claymore companies, formerly Alpha and Charlie, were my ambush elements, long range and short range, respectively. Both Battle and Dagger, Bravo and Delta, were Ranger-like Korean War vintage guerrilla units, though Battle had the Vietnam-era luxury of air mobile assets when they were available to the battalion, while Dagger moved almost solely on foot once in its AO. The new configuration offered maximum flexibility for me as a commander, and the specialization of roles well compensated for my soldiers' overall low skill level. It stood to reason that if a company did just one thing all the time, be it ambushes or eagle flights or whatever, it wouldn't take long to become truly professional at it. And not only did the changes improve the overall success of the battalion, they also did wonders for individual and team morale. For the first time, the soldiers really knew what they were doing, where they were doing it, and why. John Hayes was behind the new hardcore 100%, despite the fact that I delivered it to him more or less as a fait accompli. Hayes was a great officer and an old friend from as far back as Germany, when he was a captain in the 10th Special Forces Group at Bad Tölz, and I was trying like hell to get out of the hotel business and into his organization. And he had four attributes that made him a perfect CO for this particular war, not to mention me. First, he had a great appreciation for the cutting edge, having fought in Korea for 3 years as a recon platoon leader and a rifle company commander and been wounded 4 times. Second, he'd already spent 4 years or so in Vietnam, so he had a basic understanding of the Viets and the war itself. Third, having been commissioned as an armor officer, his tactical orientation from the earliest days of his career was for shock action and flexibility, which is what I was into and what guerrilla warfare was all about. And finally, in addition to having formed and trained the 1st Ranger Battalion in the Vietnamese Army in 1962, Hayes had had a lot of G experience of his own in Southeast Asia with the Special Forces Apache and Project Delta teams. Unlike Geraci, who was a dynamic charge airborne kind of guy, John Hayes was a quiet, careful, methodical, and introspective soldier, just like the guerrilla enemy we were tasked to fight, and had, as an added bonus, a keen understanding of the Oriental mind. He was a good man whose belief in his country and his duty as a soldier would, ironically, guarantee he wouldn't make general. Though promoted below the zone to colonel in 1968, when he turned down attendance to War College 2 years in a row, he was told by the chief of the colonel's division that he'd reached the end of the line career-wise. Apparently, general officers, this guy said, didn't take kindly to people who considered continued involvement in a combat position in Vietnam more important than going to War College. But that was still in the future. In March 1969, Hayes and John Paul Vann, two men I respected enormously, and Vann being without doubt the most knowledgeable American, military or civilian, in and about the war in Vietnam, both agreed that my guerrilla battalion configuration was the best innovation that could have been effected at that stage of the Delta War. That kind of confidence behind me certainly added to my own, which itself grew daily as the hardcore moved from strength to strength. One tremendous blow in the middle of it all, though, was the night two platoons of D Company were attacked in their own ambush position by a VC element that, we conjectured later, had been watching them all day. The company was completely asleep at the switch, and its casualties were close to a score dead and wounded, including the new company commander, KIA. I was both heartsick and totally humiliated that this had happened to one of my units, and just thankful that my boss was Hayes, a warrior, who accepted probably better than I did that this sort of thing happened in war. I turned the remains of Dagger Company over to Captain Ed Clark, whose cherubic face belied his guts and nerves of steel, and in the days to come he brought the unit back to strength, both physically and in their heads, which was even more important. The rest of the hardcore, meanwhile, though sobered by word of D Company's debacle, picked it up as a lesson learned and didn't look back. The esprit of the unit was growing stronger every day, a combination of a number of factors, not least of which were the battalion's steady kill rate and the fact that the old reliable 9th Division newspaper and Stars and Stripes were beginning to write up some of the hardcore's exploits. Such recognition did wonders for morale and for producing cocky wiseasses en masse. And as I started giving back to the men many of the privileges I'd stripped away so savagely at the outset of my tour in order to bend them to my will, I couldn't help but get the feeling the 4th Battalion, 39th Infantry, was on the verge of something big. Ed Clark, new commander of Dagger Company, ran one fine guerrilla outfit. They were uptight in the vernacular of Vietnam and ready for anything when, in the early morning hours of 23 March, their listening posts spotted enemy troops slipping into attack positions. With the memory of his predecessor's last fight still fresh, Clark felt the VC knew all too well where his people were. He immediately moved his unit back a couple of hundred meters. Minutes later, two companies from the main force VC 261st Alpha Battalion launched an attack on Clark's old position, rocket launchers and light machine guns blazing. When they realized their prey had flown the coop, the VC moved slowly forward. I wanted to send in some artillery when Clark radioed his sit rep, but Dagger's CO said no, not yet. He wanted Charlie to get a little closer in. Then a VC tripped to Claymore, and it was on. The enemy's attack formations were gutted as U.S. machine guns and individual weapons tore into their ranks. In the light of popping flares, gunships placed effective fire on Charlie and his probable escape routes. Artillery crashed down too, and the enemy broke off their attack before it had really begun, making for safety as best they could. It was a good, good contact, and as dawn broke, I had tracker dogs flown in to follow the blood trails of the fleeing VC. Based on the confession of a Dagger prisoner taken during a sweep of the battle area, who said his battalion's base camp was not far away, the pursuit began in earnest, with Troop C of the Blackhawks tracing down the enemy in loaches flown barely above grass level. We could see foot tracks trampled into the young rice in the paddies, and trails where sampans had slipped through the water. From time to time, we'd find an isolated group of Viet Cong and a platoon would be dropped off to deal with them. Then, about 2 miles along, we lost both the tracks and the trails. They just disappeared in the shimmering plain of water-soaked rice paddies and mangroves. After long years in the infantry, I prided myself on having phenomenal eyes for spotting the enemy from the ground or the air using the simplest rules like, where would I move, where would I hide, so I was a little pissed off by the sudden hiccup. But then, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a black silhouette leaning against a tree, and somehow, in that instant, Charlie's entire configuration became clear to me. I could see his perimeter. I knew what he was thinking and how he was going to move. "Swing it around," I told the pilot of my CNC, and as the chopper whirled, I saw this Viet Cong slip into a hole. Then we saw other enemy soldiers moving to prepared defensive positions. The AirCav CO sent his scout ships in. One of them blew away some foliage, only to uncover a 50-caliber U.S. machine gun. The gutsy Loach pilot, whose bird uncovered it, immediately dived down and pulled that gun right out of the enemy's hole. I put four companies in a loose net around the VC positions and called in TAC Air to pummel the center and blast any escape routes that couldn't be blocked by my infantry. In the middle of the inferno that followed, my pilot told the two door gunners on our chopper to spray down the lily pads floating along the canal we were flying over. I couldn't imagine why, but the guy had done a lot of flying in the Delta, so I figured he must have a reason. As the gunners opened up, the tactic became quite clear. One by one, the lily pads bled red, and soon bodies began popping to the surface. It was another Delta trick I hadn't known before. To evade capture, the VC would go underwater, grab a lily pad, and using reeds to breathe, just float along until they were out of harm's way. 13 airstrikes later, the enemy gave up the fight. I'd put Clark's troops on the most likely escape route, figuring Dagger deserved the honor of delivering the final blows to an enemy who'd made the lethal error of tangling with them in the first place. Sure enough, as Charlie broke out of the charred foliage that had once so adeptly concealed his base camp, he ran right into Dagger Company's waiting guns. That night, Alert and Dagger made some 40 more kills as VC stragglers attempted to steal away in the dark, and when dawn came and a final count was made, the hardcore had utterly demolished the 261 Alpha's base camp, killed 143 men, and captured the battalion colors. Our own casualties were 8 WIA, none of whom needed immediate medical evacuation. I was so proud. D Company had out-G'd the G, no question about it, proving themselves to be guerrillas as dangerous and savvy as their opponents. My reaction force, Alert and Claymore Companies, 4th of the 39th and Alpha of the 6th of the 31st, had performed like total pros. There was much cause for rejoicing at FSB Danger that day. It had been a guerrilla battle like Hank Emerson's 2nd of the 502nd had fought at Bujah Mop, that is, recognizing we were on to something big and consolidating our forces around the enemy. It was a battle fought as the first of the 327th's Mekong battle should have been fought 3 years before, and it was a battle that most likely would not have been fought the way it was had I not been in charge or someone like me who had had his Mekong, who had learned how high the price was, regardless of what Benning continued to teach, of closing with our guerrilla enemy when our superior firepower could be used not just to destroy our foe, but actually to preserve American lives. This time around, not one life was wasted, because I'd been there before and I'd learned. How different the war would have been in 1969 if all of us who'd fought and learned in those early days had stayed through the years as our brothers and fathers did in World War II, rather than being rotated out to make way for the ticket punchers or to advance our own careers with assignments we didn't even want. If the mostly draftee hardcore, with me about the only one who'd experienced anything like this battle before, could capture the battalion colors of a unit that had moved relatively freely throughout the Delta for years. The 261st had been the heroes of Op Bach, the momentous 1962 battle that became Ho Chi Minh's rallying cry of the revolution in the South, and deal that force a stinging defeat. Imagine the long-term success an experienced battalion of men would have had. After the fight, I sent Dagger Company back to Dong Tam, ostensibly to train, but more so to stand down, drink beer, and savor their victory. Besides, I knew word of the action would quickly make the rounds at division, and I wanted the Remps back there collecting combat pay to know what real warriors looked like. The following day, Hayes informed me an award ceremony had been scheduled for the men of Dagger. I was happy to hear about it, but I didn't want to attend. The battalion had the assets, and I had a feeling of unease about going off to Dong Tam and leaving them on their own. Hayes insisted, however, so I briefed Nev Bumstead on what I had in mind for the day, which was to go back to the previous day's battlefield to get the VC I felt sure would return to pick up their dead. But, I told him, under no circumstances was he to get decisively engaged. Then Hayes and I flew off to Dong Tam. The whole time I was away, I was worried. Worry bordering on panic. I was not where I should have been. I could feel it. By the time the awards ceremony was over, I was frantic. Finally, we headed home, and the minute we got within radio range, I called the hardcore. Neb sounded downright exhilarated as he reported we had a great contact going and everything was just fine. Hayes took me to the scene in his C&C and immediately I knew why I'd been so concerned. All the while we'd been at Dong Tam, my B company was having the shit shot out of it. The unit was in the middle of a 300-meter paddy devoid of cover and concealment. Two men were laying on their backs, which meant they were dead. A guy seldom lay on his back on the battlefield if he was alive. There was a psychological thing about keeping your belly close to the ground. Guys about to die, on the other hand, frequently flipped over on their backs because they didn't care about protecting their bellies anymore. I couldn't believe my eyes. Hayes dropped me off immediately, and Nev, whom I probably would have punched out if I hadn't had a higher priority, swooped down in my C&C to pick me up. Battle Company was being pinned down by four machine companies, a bastard of a sniper, and a continuous stream of RPG rounds. They couldn't effectively return fire for fear of hitting their own men, and each time Lieutenant William Torpy, the young B Company XO and acting company commander, standing in for Bob Knapp, who was on R&R, tried to get them low-crawling to the safety of a ditch, they drew more fire. It wasn't that the men could not get out. It was just that they were seriously hampered by a simultaneous effort to extract a number of their severely wounded. I took charge of the battle, but no matter what I did, I couldn't bust Charlie's ass hard enough to allow those kids to come up for air. I used tear gas, napalm, artillery, white phosphorus, airstrikes, the works. I drew on all the combat experience and knowledge I'd ever collected, my entire bag of tricks, and nothing helped. When I finally ran out of options, I decided to go in and get the wounded out myself. It was the only way I could think of to give Torpy room to maneuver. I asked the pilot and his crew if they'd volunteer, because I knew it was going to be a hell of a mess on the ground. I told the gunship commander to keep firing on the wood line where the machine guns were blazing, hoping to persuade Charlie to keep his head down. My chopper crew were good men and with me all the way, and we soon landed, right under a machine gun, within 30 feet of the wounded men. The gunships, meanwhile, began to hose down the enemy positions that were in very close proximity to our ship. One by one, they swooped down and blasted those positions, and they continued to do so the whole time we were on the ground. They were our saving grace. Bullets punched through the chopper as Nev and I jumped out. Together we ran over to the farthest wounded guy, grabbed him, ran back, and tossed him into the bird where he was attended to by Captain Schwartz, an Air Force doc who'd replaced Holly. We picked up a second WIA the same way, and then a third, amazingly, without becoming casualties ourselves, but by the time everyone was loaded onto the helicopter, there was no room inside for me. I stood on the skids and put my crash helmet on so I could tell the pilot to take off. At the time, he was just where he should have been, given the circumstances, that is, as close to the floor of the chopper as possible, using its console as cover, but I found I couldn't talk. I was so dried out my tongue had welded itself to the roof of my mouth out of pure fear. I had to open my canteen and drink some water before I could even gasp. "Let's get this mother out of here!" We took the wounded back to danger and returned to the fight. Without anything to hold him up now, I couldn't figure out why Torpy didn't do something about getting his men consolidated outside of that paddy. He still kept saying he was pinned down. Finally, I lost my temper. I really chewed his ass over the radio, demanding he get cracking and get those men out of that paddy, like, now. Apparently, the next thing he did was put down the radio, stand straight up, and begin running from man to man to get them to move back. He got mowed down right away and died a short time later. Maybe I hadn't learned a damn thing at MECON, or from Dennis Foley's near miss in that minefield. I hadn't asked Torpy to stand up. He didn't need to in order to extricate himself, and it hadn't occurred to me that he would. But I had been playing the game as if Knapp, a natural and more seasoned leader, was in charge. It was due to the force of my word as his commander that this inexperienced young lieutenant was sent to his death. Like Jim Gardner's, Torpy's death was a big guilt thing for me, and has remained so all my life. Dark was coming. With the exception of one lieutenant, all of B Company's officers had been killed or wounded. I sent Nev in to get the unit organized and withdrawn from the paddy. As night fell, all the wounded were evacuated and the unit was safely out of the machine gun's reach. But it had been a defeat, a stinging defeat, and a waste of good men's lives damn hard for me to accept, especially after our brilliant victory just 2 days before. But before I had a chance to figure out how to reverse our fortunes, my chopper, flying low over the now mostly quiet battle area, took a serious spray of machine gun slugs in the belly. My artillery LNO got hit in the gut, and I took one in the leg. At first glance, my wound didn't seem so bad, but the LNO needed immediate medical attention, so I called Hayes and told him I was going in. Hayes put Mergner in charge of the battalion, and Chum Robert, now the brigade liaison officer, came down to help until replacement for the wounded LNO was found. In the subsequent hours, the two tried to get something going with the enemy, but the goal would prove elusive. On the one hand, Billy Winston, the company commander of Alert Company, which had been sent in to take the pressure off battle and to salvage the fight, was about to go tilt in a bona fide nervous breakdown, and on the other, Nev Bumstead, though courageous by day, had had his bottle fill up and overflow 3 years previously during the first of the 101's fight for Doc Toe, and as a result, he seemed to become almost paralytic, operationally speaking, in the dark. Consequently, there was no seal and no sweep of the area. The morale-shattered remnants of B Company, which had taken 6 dead and about 18 wounded, and the leaderless men of A basically squatted in their holes until morning, during which time the VC ran away. To make matters worse, one of our ammo resupply choppers, trying to negotiate an ill-thought-out 2-small LZ in the darkness, hit a tree and crashed to the ground, killing one of the door gunners who was pinned in the wreck and burned alive, and tossing exploding ammo all over the perimeter. Talk about a bad night. My CNC was still operational after it got hit, so we bypassed danger and flew directly to the 3rd Surgical Hospital at Dong Tam to get my LNO looked at. There I found I wasn't walking too well myself, so 2 guys carried me in. At the door I ran into Gutsy Charlie Winsor, the HQ company medic. He saluted smartly and said, "Hardcore Recondo, sir." And immediately a chorus of "Hardcore Recondo, sirs" rang out from within the emergency room. The unwavering hardcore spirit among these guys who just paid the price themselves was a huge boost for my morale, and I certainly needed it, because I was steaming. There was no excuse for what had happened on that battlefield. I was mad as hell that I didn't know what was happening there now, and one place I knew I didn't want to be was in the hospital. Especially this hospital, which, as I lay on a stretcher waiting to go into surgery, happened to be under a heavy mortar attack, as was the rest of the Dong Tam installation. Fortunately, the little room where I was waiting was, in fact, an underground reinforced bunker. For the moment at least, it kept out the debris of the mortar fire, but did nothing to prevent most of D Company under Captain Clark from storming in to see me. Still on their short vacation, the guys had heard I was hit and thought I could use a lift. They brought beer and war stories, and we swilled both down, talking loudly and just ignoring the mortar rounds crashing down outside. When we were all there together, it might as well have been rain. The verdict on my wound was serious, but it could have been a lot worse. The bullet entered my leg just below the calf and came out 4 inches higher up. It missed the shin bone by millimeters, without which I probably would have lost the leg, and only a small amount of leg muscle was damaged. Still, the decision was made that I would be evacuated to Long Bin and then to Japan. It was the worst word I could get. If I went to Japan, I'd be dropped from the theater roles of Vietnam and I'd lose the hardcore. I immediately set to work figuring out a way to thwart this eventuality, but soon realized it could well be an irrelevant concern. The way things looked, I was never even going to get out of Dong Tam, alive, that is. Just as the chopper full of wounded I was on took off, enemy mortar rounds scored a direct hit on a huge World War II-style, totally inappropriate for a guerrilla war ammo dump nearby. The dump exploded like something I've never seen. Hundreds and thousands of rounds setting one another off like a world premiere 4th of July. It was really quite beautiful, save for the whizzing shrapnel and the fact that our medevac helicopter actually leaped into the sky from the concussion and was being buffeted in all directions. Throughout, I found myself laughing out of pure fear, and I greeted our ultimate arrival at Long Bin with great relief. There I was looked at by a light Colonel Regular Army Doc who was most understanding of my desire to stay in country. Since I couldn't stay at Long Bin until my wound healed, he suggested reverse evacuating me back to MASH at Dong Tam. This is exactly what happened, and though I didn't get back to the battalion on a full-time basis for some time, at least I didn't lose it. Meanwhile, it was more than ably commanded by XO George Mergner. Without too much to do during the 3 weeks I was recuperating, I had plenty of time to think, and what I thought about most was Nev Bumstead, my S3, whom I'd personally chosen and brought with me to the 4th of the 39th. It was the first time in my career that I had to say I'd truly blown it in the judgment department. Nev Bumstead was, in appearance, almost a caricature of a soldier. He was a small, slender, intense guy who took his soldiering very seriously, and himself as well, and who had or carried all the warrior gimmicks, a folding stock shotgun, a bone-handled knife which he hung upside down on a shoulder strap for quick draw, jungle boots with Velcro fasteners so he could get in and out of them fast, and web gear and load-bearing equipment almost invisible under the myriads of grenades and ammo pouches he always had hanging around his waist. As weird as Nev looked, however, was as erudite as he was, particularly in the ways of the military. He was also incredibly meticulous and thorough, attributes I came to appreciate in the years after he served with me in the 101, during which time he was an enormous help getting photographs together for the Vietnam primer and some articles I'd written, and keeping me informed throughout those dry Pentagon days on how went the war from the on-the-ground perspective of his next Vietnam assignment. So when the 439 came up, it was only natural that I'd want him on my team. I made him my operations officer because it was the perfect staff job for this perfect staff officer. I was basically my own S3 on an operational level. What I needed Nev for was to take care of the details, write the never-ending reports, and read my maps so I always knew where I was. Unfortunately, Nev wanted to be, and from the first acted as if he were, my deputy commander rather than the S3 staff officer I hired. It was bad enough that part of his new act was a curt, sometimes downright rude manner toward his subordinates, but much worse was that he began giving orders that were not his as a staff officer to give. In this way, he quickly became more of a liability than an asset on the battlefield, so I soon began to leave him back at the base camp to take care of the hundreds and hundreds of little operational things that had to be attended to, due to the nature of our many movements and varied missions, and let Chum Robert do what I couldn't on the battlefield. What I hadn't realized was that Nev Bumstead, after 4 tours, had been in Vietnam too long. He was burned out. He no longer had the capacity for the job, even back at the base camp. It was soon apparent that the admittedly cracking pace I set battle-rattled him, the priorities eluded him, and my impatient demand for perfection had him quaking. And as I watched him begin to slip, and then to make more and more mistakes, like falling asleep in meetings or in the middle of radio transmissions, I became even more impatient, and then angry, and unforgiving. Meanwhile, since all Nev really wanted was to be a warrior, not unlike a little kid might want to be a clown after his first visit to the circus, the only time he really came alive was during big fights, even when he was the whole way back at the firebase. When Chum and I were in the middle of that hunt-organized LERP exercise, for example, trying to bring in reinforcements, evacuate wounded, and chase away the Viet Cong, Nev called me on the radio from FSB Moore to say, "Sounds like you're really doing a job in there, King David," and again later to say, "Hey, King David, there's a cold beer back here just waiting for you." I didn't know what the King David crap was all about, but besides the fact that it was really embarrassing, the guy was tying up the net with bullshit when he shouldn't have been saying anything. He just wanted to be part of the action, and it was through this sort of thing I came to conclude that for Nev, combat was cops and robbers, and all his Batman gear, which I'd always chosen to ignore, was part of some make-believe toy soldier's game, which translated into the real world with real soldiers, had the potential for being the deadliest game of all. And then had come the B Company disaster, after I'd told him specifically not to get decisively engaged, and after I'd told myself I'd be damned before I'd let him play his games with the lives of the men in my command. I held him fully responsible for every single death that occurred that day, and for the entire mess, and that was irrespective of his bravery on the ground with me in picking up those wounded. As one participant in the battle put it, it is said that there is a fine line between heroism and a court-martial. In this case, I feel Major Bumstead qualified for both. For so long I'd contemplated relieving Nev, always trying to figure out a way to do it that would ease him out yet save my pride at the same time. It just wasn't done for a new battalion commander to bring his own S3 into a unit. So having done that, and having sung Nev's praises to everyone from the first day because I believed in him, to then turn around and fire the man would have made me look pretty stupid. But I'd let it all go on too long, and now 6 men were dead as a result, so I couldn't wait any longer. I decided to relieve Nev, and not only that, to make sure he never had the chance to command combat troops again, never had a chance to kill 6 men, or 600, or 6,000, to be another Mark Clark at San Pietro just because war to him was nothing more than a big game of cops and robbers. And the way I did it was by zeroing him out on his ER. It was a completely calculated effort on my part, and never before or after did I use the terrible rating system I despised so much, so completely, in the very manner for which I despised it. ERs were so inflated by now that careers could be ruined by a percentile score of 85, that is, the ranking of this officer in comparison with all Army officers of this grade and branch I know well enough to rate. I gave Nev a 25%. I said he should not be promoted, and I did not recommend him for further military schooling. Bumstead never did command troops again, but years would pass before I would realize I could have accomplished the same result without being so extreme, without destroying a man's dignity. I was angry at the time, over-emotional because of the unnecessary casualties, smarting, too, from the embarrassment Nev had caused me, and, most of all, disturbed by my own lack of balls earlier in the piece. I should have gotten rid of him right away, not covered my ass for weeks and weeks just to save face, but probably even worse in the long run, was that while I knew for certain that Bumstead had to go and used the system to make sure he did, I did nothing about Billy Winston, the A Company commander who went flat crazy after I was evacuated. At the time, no one understood why I described Winston's abrupt departure as a change of command, how I could say that his crack-up was a combat casualty, no different from being hit in the arm or leg. It was only years later that I understood why they were so puzzled. I always thought I spared Winston because I knew he had great potential as a staff officer, even if he should no longer command troops. Somehow it never occurred to me that by not addressing his breakdown in the field, I'd done nothing to prevent him from again commanding troops. One day, as commander of a division, a corps, or an army, he could just as easily lose it all over again. His bottle had filled, just as Nev's had at Dock Toe, and I should have let that be known. On the other hand, perhaps the reason Winston was spared and Nev was not, was that I didn't see Winston spinning out over the edge, as I did see Nev, working too hard, getting no sleep and screwing everything up. While as a rule I tried to ensure that the troops got enough rest, or at least rested at the right times, like between 1600 hours and darkness, a time when tired soldiers had a tendency to become careless and take the preponderance of booby trap casualties, I had different standards for the officers. My reasoning was that if I could get along with little to no sleep, and I was a good 10 to 12 years older, then so should my officers. And if that was unrealistic, if you asked me then, I'd have said, too bad. War is a serious business, and with the lives of men at stake, you can't wait around for the second-string players. The most striking thing about Winston and Bumstead was that both were truly dedicated, super-conscientious, overly bright graduates of the military academy. They were the typical West Point product, skilled in good manners and the social sciences, but not cut out for warriorhood. It was a failing of the Academy that the fighters among its graduates, the Pattons, the Gavins, the Emersons, the Willises, the Howards, and the Browns, were increasingly becoming the exceptions, not the rule. And it was a disservice to both the officers who came out of the school and the nation they pledged to serve that getting down on the ground was among the last things the students were prepared for when they graduated from West Point. As soon as I got off my crutches and onto a cane, I went back to the hard core. In my absence, our guerrilla battalion tactics had continued to strike at the heart of the enemy, because we made a point of never establishing a routine. For the first time, the VC were the ones kept guessing, and with the generous contribution of the snipers, our body counts, calculated in 9th Division arithmetic, that is, 2 plus 2 equals 8, were constantly high. As their confidence and pride grew, the men of the hardcore started talking about ways to let the VC know what unit was dishing out the relentless punishment they were receiving. Until now, the men had made do just flipping the 1st Brigade's calling card on the enemy dead, the Rakondo symbol printed on a small piece of cardboard, with a little message in Vietnamese explaining to the living how and why the deceased